Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In a recent piece for The Guardian, today's guest, Robert Reich, writes, quote, "No other developed nation has nearly the inequities found in the U.S., even though all have been exposed to the same forces of globalization and technological change. The inequalities of income and wealth that fueled Donald Trump's victory 4 years ago is now wider than ever," end quote. So we know now that Jeff Bezos' net worth recently reached $200 billion. The net worth of billionaires has climbed from $2.9 trillion to $3.5 trillion during the pandemic, as 30 million people say their households do not have enough to eat. That is one in eight homes. Despite a federal ban, many renters are still being evicted. Democrats support an extension of $600 in weekly federal unemployment benefits, but the Republicans will not budge. We have done so many shows about these issues. We recently highlighted a new Frontline documentary about child poverty. We also have done many shows about evictions. So what needs to be done about mass inequality, the struggle to make ends meet, and uncertainty facing millions of people and families across the country? What is at stake in the upcoming election? It's in just 48 days. Today, we are joined by Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, co-founder of Inequality Media, and author of many books, including his latest, The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. Professor Reich also writes a column for The Guardian. Hi, Professor Reich. Welcome back to the show.
Well, good morning, Rose.
Well, good morning, Professor Reich. You go on live on Facebook almost a couple times a week talking about all of these issues. And I just wonder, there's so much, Professor Reich. Even before COVID, people were having a hard time making ends meet. And now you've got people who lost their jobs. They do not know when they will get their jobs back. It's hitting people at all levels of income now. So how are you thinking about this moment that we are in?
Well, when I'm not despairing, I'm trying to be optimistic about the possibilities of change. And I go back into history, Rose. The Gilded Age of the late 19th century, the 1880s, 1890s, was remarkably similar to what we're going through now. Obviously, there was not a pandemic. At least there was, actually, in 1918. But the Gilded Age did have huge gaps in income and wealth and power. It had the kind of corruption we are seeing, the cynicism about government, and many people in the United States feeling that democracy was hopeless, it was not working, ultimately leading toward, you saw in the 1920s, socialism, fascism, communism become real alternatives for many in the world, not in the United States, but we did flirt with all of these things. It seemed as if the system was not working. And it's very similar today. We have the same kind of wealth disparities. The pandemic has made it all worse. The robber barons of the Gilded Age now have slightly different roles. They are not exactly the same people, but certainly Elon Musk and Jeffrey Bezos and others and Zuckerman and Zuckerberg, others like them, they seem to have many of the same traits as the robber barons did in the late 19th century. And they are contributing in their own ways to the same chasm in terms of the gap between a very small number of people who have more and more wealth and power and the vast number of people who are holding on, barely holding on. Now, Rose, here's the good news. What makes me optimistic is that that Gilded Age of the late 19th century was followed by an era that we now call the Progressive Era. And that was a kind of an upsurge of reform, of change, of people in the United States demanding that democracy be restored and also that the economy work for almost everybody. Now, it was not a perfect period of time. There was still a lot of racism. There were still women were still second-class citizens. But we did change the rules of the game dramatically.
Okay, so to your point, Professor Rice, changing the rules of the game will require politicians who agree with these changes and then a mass movement of people who push them. And we do have a number of incredible movements happening across the country. The election is just in 48 days. So let's talk a little bit about the importance of voter turnout right now. Yesterday, the Poor People's Campaign, an incredible group, actually last night, they had a forum. And the Reverend William Barber pointed out that 62 million people work every day in this country for less than a living wage. 140 million people in the U.S. are poor or low income. And he said, the reality is the parties tend not to talk to these people because voter turnout is very low. And he said, if we could just mobilize a small percentage of people who do not vote, things would drastically change. So, Professor Rice, can you talk about the importance of voter turnout in this election?
Well, it's critical. The surveys and the polls mean absolutely nothing because the real issue today is how many people are going to turn out. And turnout depends on motivation. Are people enthusiastic either for or are they incredibly against one of the candidates? Donald Trump has certainly brought out the divisiveness in America. That's an understatement. And so a lot of people are going to be going to the polls as a referendum on Donald Trump. But there is not the kind of movement right now that we have seen in a few of our former elections, and I go back really almost 200 years, to the extent that people are going to be coming out and voting because they have a vision of what they want America to be. And I think what Reverend Barber was talking about was the degree to which the formal party structures no longer, if ever, I mean, there was a time, I suppose, in the 60s when you could say the Democratic Party was more responsive to the poor and also to the working class. But the parties as party structures are really not responding to the enormous gaps in wealth, income and power we have in this country. And I think part of the reason is because, frankly, a lot of money in politics doesn't come from poor people. It doesn't come from the working class. The money that propels politics today, that pays for the ads, that pays for the public relations and the political consultants, that money, to a larger extent than ever before, is coming from people at the top. Now, having said that, let me quickly add that we have seen in very recent years, in the 2016 election and also in this election, a lot of small donations from millions of people who have never donated before. And that is changing the calculus somewhat.
So to that point, people need a reason to vote, Professor Rice. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people who do not vote, who are low income, and say the politicians don't come to our area. They do not talk to us. So let's talk about that, because people are really struggling. I mean, we've had on people. We had on a woman from Denver, Colorado, who had to move out of her apartment. She moved into an RV because she could not make it ends meet. As I said in the intro, we just did a show about child poverty. A Frontline documentary did a great job of just really elevating the voices of people in Ohio. So, Professor Rice, in order to ensure that we have high voter turnout, especially low-income people need to be given a reason to vote.
They do. And I think that Joe Biden has put across some very, very important campaign messages and ideas and visions. But I think the reason that a lot of people are going to vote in this election is because Donald Trump is such a menace. That is, I think the referendum on Trump is going to be the centerpiece of this election. Now, then, after Joe Biden is elected, I think then, 45 days from now, we have an opportunity to push the Biden administration, assuming he gets in, to do the things that an administration ought to be doing for the poor and for the working class, for people in the bottom half of this country who have been disenfranchised from the economy. But right now, it's very difficult to see that happening, Rose. I, it's a kind of a chicken and egg problem. If people don't get out to vote, then we are going to have another 4 years of Trump. If they do get out to vote, how are they going to be? Are they going to be motivated by a vision? And if is that vision really going to be a vision of a new kind of economic structure, a new set of possibilities? In the midst of COVID, in the midst of this economic downturn, in the midst of wildfires, I'm looking out my window. It's a little bit better today than it was yesterday and the day before. And there are so many crises simultaneously occurring that I think, quite frankly, people are overwhelmed. I know I am. People who have economic problems don't know what to do. They're barely surviving. And the idea of voting, sadly, is not at the top of their list. But it needs to be. It should be. It must be, because there's no hope for change unless people actually vote.
Let's give people an update on the unemployment benefits, because that $600 in federal unemployment benefits really was a lifeline for so many people. It expired. The Democrats support an extension. The Republicans are not budging. Professor Reich, this is one of the main reasons why people are being evicted and just can't afford to put enough food on the table. Because at the state level, I mean, in some states, they're bringing in $200 a week in unemployment. It's just impossible to make ends meet on that.
Rose, in some states, it's even less than that. I mean, the typical unemployment benefit without that federal extra $600 a week was 45% of one's previous job. Now, a lot of people in this country under normal unemployment benefits would be bringing in maybe $70 a week, $60 a week. You can't support yourself even in periods in parts of the country where rents and homes are less expensive than they are in the Bay Area or in on the East Coast. So it is a real crisis. And the ending of that $600 a week benefit on July 31st has plunged millions and millions of Americans into a situation where that nobody expected to be in. Nobody expected anybody to have to face. It's the, there are a lot of things that get me angry right now, but one of the things that makes me angriest is that the Republicans would not respond to a bill that the Democrats have had out there since May. The HEROES Act, it's called, the acronym, basically the extending that $600 a week, but also providing states and localities the money they need, because states and localities are running out of money. They can't simply go on with regard to education, healthcare, and all of the ways in which states and cities are first responders to these crises. They're running out of money, and therefore the situation is going to become even worse very, very shortly.
Today, we are speaking with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about what it will take to deal with income inequality and economic crisis under COVID. And if you would like to join the conversation, if you've got a story to share, how are you doing right now? You, your family, your circle of friends, how are you all holding up during all of this? And what are some of the major changes that you would like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Rice, you know more than many about how we got to this place. Just in terms of the politics, over the weekend, the New York Times had a special section called Greed is Good, Except When It's Bad. And it was about a magazine article they published back in 1970. So they looked at how things have changed since then. And if you just look at, for example, CEO compensation back in 73 was $1.2 million. Now it's $21 million. You know, the number of millionaires has gone up. Just workers, though, their wages have really stayed stagnant. I also would like you to talk about taxes, Professor Reich. Top marginal personal income tax was 72% back in 1970. Now it's 37%. Trump has said if he gets reelected, one of the first things he will do is once again cut taxes for the wealthy.
Well, the most amazing thing to me right now is that so many working class people, middle class people, and even some poor people think that Donald Trump is somehow responding to them, that he's a tribune of the average working person. And nothing could be farther from the truth. This man has been a stalking horse for the rich. The tax cut that was passed at the end of 2017, most of the benefits over the course of the tax cut will go to people in the top 10 or 20% of the income. Donald Trump thinks of the economy as the stock market. But of course, the stock market, the top richest 1% of Americans own half of the entire stock market of the United States. The richest 10% own 92% of the stock market of the United States. The idea that Donald Trump is in some sense working for average people is totally absurd. He does want to provide another tax cut. He has made it very difficult for working people to get ahead. He's cut a lot of the labor laws that, I know because I had been Secretary of Labor. We put into place 25 years ago. He has rolled them back. He's rolled back environmental protections that hurt the poor. Climate change hurts the poor more than it does anybody else because the poor are in the most fragile homes, in the most fragile areas. Time and again, area after area, this president has hurt the poor and the working class. And yet somehow people think he's been good for the economy. I don't really understand that. I suppose, big lies told over and over again, Rose, are eventually believed. But I think the Democratic Party has also failed to make the case. The Democrats have turned their backs over the last 40 years. On the working class, it used to be a coalition of the working class and the poor, and that is no longer the case for the Democratic Party.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but to continue with Trump, what is at stake, Professor Reich, if Trump is reelected?
Especially
when it comes to the economy.
It's very hard to know where to begin, Rose. What's at stake is not only the Supreme Court and therefore the interpretation of our very constitutional foundation documents and the Constitution itself and laws, but what's also at stake is the unity of the country. I mean, the divisiveness, the anger, the petulance that Donald Trump has created is extraordinary. The democratic institutions that are still strong but are being tested every day by what Trump is doing, those institutions, I can't guarantee, obviously no one can, that they're going to be lasting if he's reelected, that they would last another 4 years. And look at the young people in this country who are facing not only a coronavirus epidemic and bad job prospects, also the breakdown of the environment. This is the first president. Even Richard Nixon was an environmentalist. Richard Nixon signed into law the Environmental Protection Act. Donald Trump is the most anti-environmental president in our history. He says that climate change is not the cause of the things that we're going through. He says windmills cause cancer. I mean, this would be ludicrous and laughable if it weren't actually real. And another 4 years, I think, would be, it's hard to conceive of it. And for those listeners who, like me, are worrying about these things, it hit me last night as I was just going to sleep when the worries begin pouring in. Not only are we dealing with all kinds of crises right now, the gap, the voting gap in the surveys, in the polls, showing Donald Trump behind Biden, running about 6 points to 7 or 8 points in swing states, is not all that different from what I remember 4 years ago, when the same polls were showing Hillary Clinton leading Donald Trump in those same states by 4, 5, 6, 7 points. Voter turnout, we talked about a few moments ago, Rose, is so absolutely essential because Donald Trump really did win, a combination of voter turnout, Russian interference, and the Electoral College. And now we can't do much about the Electoral College or Russian interference, but voter turnout is something we can do something about. I think everybody needs to call all of their friends, all their relations, particularly in swing states, and make sure they turn out.
It is amazing, Professor Reich, looking at the numbers last time around. Trump got 62,984,000 votes, almost 985,000. Clinton, 65,853,000. And then 117 million people did not vote. And we just did a show, actually, about some of the battleground states where Trump won by, 20,000 votes. And that gave him those electoral college votes.
Well, we tend in this country to believe that the two major parties are Republicans and Democrats. That's not really the case. There's a third party that is bigger than any other party, and that is the party of non-voters. It seems ironic to call them a party, but actually they constitute a much larger group of people than either the Democrats or the Republicans. And if that party of non-voters begins to get to the polls, that obviously is the critical deciding factor. I'm obviously worried, as I'm sure you are, about voter suppression, about purging of voter rolls, about making it difficult for people to even get to the polls, about slowing down the mails, all of the ways in which Trump and his enablers may be making it harder for people to vote. But that doesn't mean we need to be or should be cynical. In fact, quite the opposite. I think that cynicism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've got to be cautiously optimistic, and we've got to, all of us, demand that this country, this democracy, this economy begin working for all of us once again.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Jim in Martinez. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Let me say what a real honor it is to be able to speak with Professor Reich. I wonder what it will take to get Republicans, and there are some out there, that the never Trumpers, the people, what will it take to get anybody to stand up to this guy? I mean, I just started reading Rage this morning. I started reading Strzok's book, and I'm filled with the overwhelming feeling like no matter what people say, what they write, it's not going to do any good. It won't change voters. They're already entrenched, and I'm just full of despair, although I certainly plan to vote. But anyway, that's basically it. What will it take to get people to stand up to this idiot and do something about him? They could. They could declare the 25th Amendment and make it. He's unfit.
Well, I agree with you, Jim. I think that he's unfit. I think he should have been convicted of impeachment. But here we are now, less than 7 weeks before the election. In fact, exactly 7 weeks. It seems to me that your question requires a more complicated answer than I probably can give. But let me give it a try, because I did work in government. I worked for four presidents. I kind of know Congress and the Senate and the House. And it seems to me that while there are an extraordinary number of Republicans, former government officials, and people who are quite prominent people who have been Republicans in the past, and they have been speaking out in great numbers, I have been surprised and saddened by the lack of courage among current Republican members of the House and Senate. Now, in my understanding of what's happened, and I know some of them, and I've talked to some of them personally, they say it would be suicidal politically for them to stand up against Trump. My response to them is, well, don't you have a responsibility to the country? I mean, your own political future is not as important as the country. Why don't you just stand up to him? And then if you're voted out, so be it. But the lack of courage, the lack of backbone, the lack of principle among so many Republican members of Congress and senators is appalling. It's really staggering at a time like this.
Well, thank you for the call. Today, we're speaking with Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, co-founder of Inequality Media, and author of The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. We're going to take a quick short break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about what it will take to truly address the economic crisis under COVID and growing inequality. The election is in just 48 days. We're joined by Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, co-founder of Inequality Media, and the author of many books, including The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have a couple of comments on Twitter, Professor Reich. Tommy writes, what will it take to tackle the economic crisis? That's simple, an end to the one-party political system that serves the 0.01%, the Republicrats. You know, Professor Reich, I think this is really important because the media always say that half the country voted for Trump, which that's not true. It's 25%. And that we're so divided. But as you said, the biggest voting bloc are non-voters. So we really don't know where the entire country stands because so many people don't vote. Frontline had an interesting doc, I think it was like 6 months ago, called Divided. And they looked at all these different issues, whether it's minimum wage increase, taxing the wealthy, gun control. An overwhelming majority of the people want these issues. But a minority, five Republicans, once Breitbart gets a hold of it, and as you said, they will run someone to the right of these Republicans, and so they switch their votes from yes to no, and that derails the whole thing. So it really is a minority that's making so many of these decisions. And we've been talking about that for years. How do we end that grip?
Well, we end the grip really at when enough people in this country become outraged enough, angry enough to do something about it. My concern is that Trump and his enablers have taken that anger and channeled it toward Muslims and black people and people who really have absolutely no responsibility for what's happened, and therefore have used that anger to split us even more. If you step back from all of this, Rose, I think what's happened over the last 40 or 50 years, and I've seen it certainly in my working lifetime, is that more and more wealth and power have concentrated at the very top. I've called this group the kind of new American oligarchy, using the word oligarchy because I think it's appropriate. It's an old Greek term meaning a system in which wealth and power is concentrated in the hands of a very few, and that everybody else is more or less disenfranchised economically and politically. And what's happened, I think, is that oligarchy has created a system that not only rewards them and keeps everybody else down, but really does use a kind of divide and conquer strategy. I think that the CEOs of America have not stood up against Trump. They've got all of the tax cuts they've wanted. They've got the regulatory rollbacks they've wanted, but they've also got something else from Trump. And I'm saying this advisedly and carefully because I don't want to be misunderstood. But I think that the kind of vicious racism that we've seen under Donald Trump and the kind of xenophobia, nativism, the kind of angry anger against foreigners that we've seen under Trump, those are kinds of divisiveness and divisive strategies that keep Americans from joining together, keep Americans from understanding our common needs, keep Americans from mobilizing to take back our democracy and, frankly, to take back our economy. I don't want to suggest that the strategy is so direct and so obvious that any individual member of the oligarchy, any individual CEO of a big company is necessarily guilty. I want to suggest something more subtle. And that is that divisiveness actually works to the benefit of people at the very top because it keeps everyone else believing that their real enemy is somebody who is just in the same boat they are, or practically in the same boat they are. Americans are kind of we're angrily dividing up the crumbs when the pie is going to the people at the very top, and the people at the top don't seem to mind that very much.
So to your point, Professor Reich, about the Democrats really failing to address these issues, you know, what can you tell us about Biden's economic plan? Because I've heard him say that he supports, I believe it's a $13 an hour increase for frontline workers. He supports the $15 an hour wage, you know, which is all well and good. But what about the people who are just really struggling to make ends meet right now? That one-time $1,200 check, a number of senators on the Democratic side wanted that to continue every month. In fact, I believe Bernie was for a $2,000 a month plus the $600 in unemployment just to keep people above water. But what do you know about Biden's plan and how he would help people? Because if he wins and takes office in January, I mean, these issues are going to be with him for, you know, the next 4 years.
Well, I can tell you this, Rose. Biden is a good man. I know him. He is not where I am politically. I'm much closer to Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. But he can be pushed. He can listen. He can analyze. He has a brain. He's capable of understanding where things need to move. And he's also movable. In other words, I don't want to engage in any false equivalence between the Democrats and Republicans. I think there is a big difference. Unfortunately, both do have corporate Wall Street parts of each party. But Joe Biden is, I think, someone who will be amenable to the kind of movements that we see growing already in the Democratic Party, outside the Democratic Party, at the grassroots, among young people, among people of color, Black Lives Matter. I think Joe Biden could very easily be the kind of leader we saw. I was alluding earlier in this program to the Gilded Age and the progressive era following the Gilded Age. I think he could be somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, who in 1901 became president. Nobody knew him. Nobody thought he was really going to be the kind of leader he became, but he was exactly right for the times. And so was his fifth cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in 1932, when nobody expected all that much. Nobody knew all that much about Franklin D. Roosevelt, but he was exactly right for the times. I don't want to build up expectations too high for Joe Biden, but I do think that Biden is positioned exactly right at a point in time when Americans are ready for fundamental change. We've had too much of Trump. We've had too much of these crises, the COVID, the environmental disasters, the Black Lives Matter movement and police brutality. People are now saying to themselves, enough. This country is not sustainable in the direction we're going now. We have got to fundamentally change. And I think that Biden may get ahead of that parade.
Today, we're speaking with former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Robert Reich is my hero. And there's a lot of things I could talk about, but as he wrote in his book, I'll be short. I'm not crazy about Biden. I was a Bernie Warren fan. But my problem and the reason I am so upset is that Biden keeps talking about Trump. He's not going to win election talking about Trump and not putting forth his programs. I know that I've heard a lot about Latino vote, and they're not excited about him. And if he loses the Latino vote, he'll never get into the White House. And even Bernie has said, you know, why isn't he talking about his programs? I mean, the hell with Trump. We all know what a terrible, terrible man he is. and with 2 months left to the election, he's got to, you know, he's got to get out of that and talk about all, you know, the programs that he's going to put forth and try to get some excitement into the electorate.
Well, Nancy, I agree with you. I think that Biden has got to talk more about what he's going to do and less about what Trump has done and the awfulness that Trump is perpetrating on this country. But at the same time, it's difficult to break through. And I know this, again, because I've been in Washington. I've worked in Washington. The press has a natural attraction for sensationalism. And Trump is a sensationalist. I mean, Trump cannot be ignored. He is the elephant, or the distorted elephant in the middle of the room. And this election, like any election of where you have an incumbent president, is almost inevitably an election where the achievements or the failures of the incumbent become very, very central. So I think it's a matter not so much of Biden fundamentally changing his campaign, but I think I agree with you. I think it's a matter of Biden beginning to pivot to talk more about what he's going to do and less about what Trump has done, even though every day Trump provides a huge target.
Well, thank you for calling in, Nancy. We're actually going to talk about the Latino vote tomorrow, so I hope you can tune in for that. Let's go next to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Nice to hear from you.
Oh, thank you very much. Boy, Professor Reich, I always look forward to your videos. So I appreciate so much what you do. Okay, my contribution to this is both a short-term observation and a long-term hope, I guess. I'm terribly concerned about the voter suppression that's going on right now. It's just incredible to me what's happening in Florida, and I'm sure several other states have heard a little bit about it, but just unbelievable. Anyway, that's one. The long-term observation I would make, oh, my God, shocked that 140 million people who do not vote, that's nearly half of our entire population of the citizens in this country. Whatever it is, 330 million. Okay, finally, on the long term suggestion, I think it's absolutely essential that we properly fund schools all across this country somehow. I wish there were a federal contribution to it right now, because now it's just the states. But if we made a point of giving proper funding for the schools and including a little bit of education about civics and on the duty of citizens to vote, I think that would make a difference in the long run for people just to express their actual hopes along the way. That's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, GS. Professor Reich, can you take the first part of the question about voting? And I just want to point out that the New York Times had a piece yesterday about creating a legal war room. They're preparing for a big fight over voting. They've got two former solicitors general and hundreds of lawyers. They're bracing for an extended legal battle, hoping to maintain trust in the electoral process.
Well, trust is the key word, Rose. I think that the big danger to my mind in all of the attempts at voter suppression going on right now is the cynicism that it fosters in the public's mind about the reason to vote. That is, if voter suppression is going on, that's bad enough. But if people believe that voter suppression makes their own votes simply meaningless, you're going to have millions of people added to the rolls of the non-voters. And that means not only another term for Trump, but it means further distrust in the entire system. What we need to do, all of us, is not only to fight voter suppression, but also to fight the cynicism that accompanies voter suppression. That party of non-voters we were talking about a moment ago, that gigantic number of people who don't vote, who have not voted in past elections, and who really don't even think about themselves as voters, and they don't understand it as a responsibility. As GS said, not only do they need to be reached in schools, but they need to be reached right now. We've got to talk to everybody we know in our own communities, our own circle of friends, acquaintances, family. We've got to make sure that people who have given up on voting now, this year, right now, in 7 weeks, they know that it is critical and they have got to do it. And with regard to COVID, that means that a lot of people have got to mail in ballots over the next few weeks.
Yes, exactly. And last Friday, we had on Ari Berman, and he said, if you live in a battleground state, if you feel safe, your best bet is to vote early and in person. Forget the mail-in ballot because there could be too many problems with it. So if you feel safe, your best bet is to vote early and in person. And we'll definitely be doing more shows about this. On this issue, Sharon writes in about what is happening in Florida. She says, this is why the poor and disenfranchised stop voting and are cynical. And Professor Reich, this is a really big deal. As you know, in 2018, 2/3 of Florida voters approved Amendment 4, which means that people who were formerly in prison would be able to vote. But we just got a ruling on Friday. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit said that any Floridians who have outstanding fines and fees, which is a lot of people, will not be able to vote in November.
Yes, I saw that. And I do think that it's a travesty, Rose. It's the kind of a legal ruling that makes me feel like we've just suddenly plunged backwards into the dark ages of American electoral history. But let's put it this way: this is an opportunity in the next few weeks for extraordinarily wealthy Americans to jump in and pay the fines and fees. I mean, that may seem a little bit odd, but they can be paid by anybody. Let's get those people voting. Let's make sure that those fines and fees are paid. We've got people. You know, Jeff Bezos made $13 billion one day 3 weeks ago, just one day. I mean, he could pay off those fines and fees and not even miss them.
Right. And that's what the Miami Herald is calling for. Thank you so much for that. I'm glad you brought that up so we could share that with listeners. Professor Reich, I also want to make sure we talk about people who do not have jobs right now and are having a really hard time getting unemployment. Talk Poverty has a piece that says 12 million people still have not received their unemployment benefits. We just got a tweet from Robert who said, Nevada's UI system had a glitch, resulting in thousands of accounts being reset. This is beyond hopelessness. Do I leave my apartment or is it being fixed? The not knowing makes it that much more stressful.
Our entire social safety net, Rose, from unemployment insurance all the way through any kind of the Affordable Care Act, which is still there and it's still important, but is not what it should be. I'm with Bernie on this. I think we need Medicare for all. We need a single payer system. But all of the social safety net is really falling apart. Most of it was created in the 1930s. I mean, unemployment insurance was part of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. And most state unemployment insurance systems are still creaky and cranky. I mean, they are so old and so outmoded, and they are not up to dealing with the kind of problems we have today. I hear over and over again, people say they still have not got unemployment checks. They don't know what to do. They've got to pay their bills. 75% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And they can't save. They don't earn enough to save. They earn enough maybe to pay the bills. But if they lose their job and they don't have a paycheck, that means that they've got to either get some source of funding, borrow money, get unemployment insurance, rely on a safety net, or they simply are going to lose their homes. They're going to be out on the street. They're going to be with relatives and friends. They're going to be sitting on couches. Young people, I know, are moving in back in with their parents. This has been a trend for a few years, but it's now really a huge wave of young people who can no longer afford to live on their own. Many of them are without jobs or without jobs that are paying enough. Meanwhile, we've got a very large and growing portion of the population that are freelance workers or contract workers whose jobs are not paying nearly enough today to live on. So they are trying to work, but they don't even qualify for state unemployment insurance because most unemployment insurance systems depend on somebody having a full-time job. So the whole system, and this is, Rose, why I entitled my last book, The System. The system itself is fundamentally outmoded and needs to change in ways that really require almost a revolutionary approach to what we are doing for unemployment, for our economy, for people who are falling out of the economy. We've got to be taking very, very seriously the notion of a universal basic income, because in the future, we're going to see more and more instances where people are not going to be able to get enough money from their employment to pay their bills. And as a result, not only is that a humanitarian crisis, but it's a crisis for the entire economy, because two-thirds of the economy depends on consumer personal spending. And if people don't have the money, they can't spend, which means nobody can the entire economy suffers. There are fewer jobs because people don't have the money to buy.
Oh, did we lose you, Professor Reich?
I hope not.
You're still there. We have about 30 seconds left. Go ahead.
I think, Rose, the point needs to be made. We have short-term crises, starting with Donald Trump, but all the way through COVID and the environment and police brutality. But we also have these long-term structural problems that lie behind this crisis. And my sincere hope, and I hope everybody listening shares this, is that we can put in a new administration that is at least amenable to being pushed in the direction of the fundamental changes we need.
Robert Reich is former U.S. Secretary of Labor and author of many books, including The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. Professor Reich, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.